Hello and welcome to my talk about security and OpenSUSE. My name is Markus Meissner. I'm with SUSE since 2002, which is now 14 years. Pretty much to the day, I started in July. I'm doing security since 2004, first as a team lead and the last 3 years as a project manager within a quite some bigger team, and I want to introduce security to you, especially also in connection what we do for OpenSUSE at various stages. So we'll be introducing the team as it is now, introduce the persons that are in the team. I will introduce what we do after the release of the OpenSUSE versions, and then talk a bit longer about what we do before the release, what we do to make releases more secure, that you will see during your factory submissions, during your tumbleweed submissions. So starting with the team, I'm part of the maintenance security team in SUSE, which is part of a level 3 maintenance department. The team leader is Thomas Biege. The team actually consists both of security and maintenance coordination people. But for this talk, I will only be talking about security, I will only mention the security people. So we have Andreas Stieger. He's hanging on the external channels as Tacit, T-A-C-I-T. I'm not actually sure what it means, but if you see that username on the factory list, on the factory channel, that's him. He's project manager and responsible for certifications and similar things, and also on the OpenSUSE maintenance side, one of the OpenSUSE maintenance coordinators. Then there's myself, also project manager, responsible also for various things that I will also pick up as a Linux soon, but also usually for the projects around incident management and outside representation. Then we have Sebastian Kramer, internal IRC, if you're an employee, SEK. He's one of our long-time security engineers. He does most of the low-level auditing. So if you need a root exploit found in one of the tools, you ask him to audit it and he will find it. So people are a bit afraid of him. So he's usually hanging on our internal security channel. Then we have Victor Pereira, original from Brazil, but living in Leipzig for several years now. He's doing Ruby, Rails, web security stuff. There's he quite an expert in. But he also is in the regular incident management. Then we have Alexander Bergmann, also security engineer. He's pretty knowledgeable now in the PCI DSS segment and other things. And last but not least, Johannes. I'm not sure if he's not in the room. I don't see him. But he's here at the conference, and he's also a security engineer and is quite knowledgeable in SE Linux and also in Ruby. So what do we do after the releases? We do the coordination and tracking of all the security incidents. So people report security bugs, and we are responsible for tracking them. So basically, we open bug reports, we assign them to the packagers, we attach all the patches and information that we find, and we ask the maintainers to submit updated packages. And once they submit the updated packages, we are using the OpenSUSE maintenance mechanisms, create incidents, put them into the OpenSUSE maintenance testing, and in the end release those packages. We also take care that things are getting submitted so that it's not forgotten. Although as OpenSUSE is a volunteer project, sometimes we don't get fixes for some packages. So especially for maintainers that don't work for SUSE, that are only occasional maintainers or that have dropped off or moved off, we have occasionally a bit problems getting submissions. So if you want to help, you can look for abandoned packages that need security fixes. that would be appreciated by the OpenSUSE users. As for maintenance, SUSE does the security support and maintenance support for OpenSUSE releases for two OpenSUSE releases and 2 months overlap. So up to some years ago, it was, as we had an 8-month release schedule that amounted to 18 months, so 1.5 years. But now with a yearly release schedule, it will be 2 years and 2 months, basically, so 26 months. This is one thing for interesting for the Leap product. So Leap 42.1 will be maintained until 2 months after Leap 42.3 has been released. So until next, so if Leap 42.2 is released this November and 42.3 is released November 2017, 42.1 will end in January 2018, our support for it. So it's, we will see how that works because Leap is a bit new to us. It's the code base between the Leap versions is occasionally not so different. So the idea of the Leap development team is that migration between the Leap dot releases, Leap 42.1, 42.2, is easier than it was for the OpenSUSE releases. If you want to look of how we track and how we where we track it, we have a specific Bugzilla product. It's called SUSE Security Incidents. We use special summary lines with val minus x and a special summary format with the CVE number and the package and the short summary, as you see over there, for tracking so that we can sort and look it up easier. The prefixes, they are not really that important except that while zero means immediate update, while one means planned update for later, for coalescing multiple updates into one, and while two we used for hopeless cases where we cannot do an update. For OpenSUSE, we usually don't do planned updates like for SLES. For OpenSUSE, we can have better turnaround times, or we don't have that much QA effort, we can release updates for every bug. This is a public product, so you can basically look at what we are doing, even if you are not a SUSE employee, so even for our SLES bugs. I collected some stats 2 days ago. So if my queries did not fail me, the last 365 days, we opened 1,500 bugs. Not all of them affect OpenSUSE, but most of them do. So it, I was kind of surprised by that big number, actually. That in turn resulted in quite a number of updates. 42.1, it's living since November, so 7 months about now, received 234 security updates, and we fixed altogether up to nearly 1,000 CVEs. So that comes from the fact that Firefox and other packages and the kernel, and so we also fix multiple CVEs per update. If you don't know what a CVE is, CVE is a unique identifier, common vulnerability enumeration. It's basically CVE minus year minus running number that is assigned by a central authority, and which can which specifies exactly what security issue the actual security issue. For OpenSUSE 13.2, I counted only the last year, last 365 days, not a full lifetime. So we had 315 security updates and a bit over 1,200 CVEs. So it's we're coming a bit now to Tumbleweed. Of course, the security issues that we encounter also affect the factory or Tumbleweed product. Up to usually that goes directly, but is directly integrated into the rolling development process. So basically, submitting the new version, submitting the bug fixes to factory, it will go through the regular continuous integration that they do. It will take some days, and it then will be available for a regular distribution update. We have, however, a shortcut mechanism. So if there is a critical security, update like OpenSSL or glibc, we had in this year, we have a method of bypassing the continuous integration. So there's a specific update project also for Tumbleweed, where we can put in updates temporarily, really on the same day, on the same hour, if we need a really very, very quick fix. So like for instance, right now, when GCC 6 is integrated, we have perhaps several days or perhaps 1 or 2 weeks where we will not publish a Tumbleweed snapshot. But if now a big security problem would happen, we would still have the chance of publishing an update to the Tumbleweed customers. The next thing that we do for Tumbleweed is that we review all new things, new security relevant things, and all these changes in security relevant things. Also, we review new technologies and have some automatisms in the build integration. Why do we need to review things? So basically, the Unix security model has the regular user and the root, the administrator user, and they are separated. Root can do, in this traditional Unix model, everything. The user can only do his own things. He can only overwrite his own files, and he cannot break the rest of the system. However, the user needs to have some flexible to configure the wireless LAN, to install updates, to configure the desktop, and so on. Some things that only root could do. And for these hardware changing or system changing methods, there are various ways where the user can do root things. Previously, it was like setuid root binaries. These days, it's more like dbus services or similar methods. And one of our tasks in the security team is review these transition paths, that these are secure and cannot be exploited to gain full root access, so that changing the resolution cannot run code on as root on the machine. So that's results that we have some automatisms. So if you build a package and have ever added a new dbus service, you will see a failure because all dbus services need to be whitelisted. After they have been reviewed by the security team, because dbus basically is a method call from the user into a root service usually, and that of course needs to be checked if there cannot be things happen that are unintended. We also review PAM modules, the authentication modules, because this is also part of the authentication stack where the user can become root, and if the module is badly written, then it could also break things. We actually found 1 or 2 problems in new PAM modules. Also, the new users and groups that are added are part of RPM Ninchecks, but are not really in the area of security. If the RPM Ninchek or the policy kit checks or something else asks you to contact the security team, the best thing is either to email us, security@suse.de or security-team@suse.de, or you can also open a bug for us, again, in a security incident product that I showed before, or in a OpenSUSE Tumbleweed category security that will also reach us. The next thing is that these transition paths, these dbus services, use PolicyKit to authenticate the user. Basically, if you see if you do a network manager and you configure something that asks for the root password, this is actually PolicyKit in the background. And PolicyKit has various defaults. One of them is no, don't allow it at all. The next one is yes. And there's the auf-admin rule. Auf-admin means it asks for the root password. And also the auf-self method, that it would ask for the user's password, which is not so often used. But auf-admin is used occasionally for when a user really wants to install a new package, for instance, or remove a package. Then that's something that can break the system or risk the system. So the root password is queried from the user. The root password is usually remembered for 5 minutes and then forgotten again. It also depends on the context. So if you are on a really on an active session, like the session that you see right now, inactive session means it's not the session you see, but if you have a multi-screen or multiple consoles, then inactive would be the console that you are not seeing, so the text console or something else. And other users are users that don't have a session associated. So, for instance, the power off method should only be used by the active user and not by some other user, for instance. So if RPM Lint complains that it's unknown, or please also contact us for approval and whitelisting. From the traditional Unix story, setuid and setdid binaries also found automatically during build. Also world writable directories. This is all handled in a permissions package, and we also review all those and approve all those if you need such a thing. We also looked at not too many daemons are running by default. One thing is, of course, the network daemons that listen to the network and where you could access the machine, but also other daemons that could be potentially exploited locally. It's also, of course, a thing that if you want to install, you only want to run all the services that you only run the services that you need, but not all services. So there's a package that called systemd presets branding OpenSUSE. In SLI, it's called systemd presets branding minus SLI. We maintain this package and we review the submit requests to it, or if you open a bug for us, we can review and enable the services. So we audit those new things, those new debug services, or anything that is security related. It's manual work mostly. So of course there are some tools, but the interesting part is really manual. It needs experience, so only some of our guys have the necessary experience, mostly the Sebastian. And usually one audit takes several days, so 1 week, 2 weeks is an approximate turnaround time. So if you open multiple audit bugs, or if multiple audit bugs come in, then it will take some weeks until we get to them. So it's not really a next day thing that we do, but it will always take time. So if you know that you need something at some point in time, tell us as early as you know it, and we can already look at it. And so if you need it in like 4 months that we, or 2 months that we can also, we can already have it ready for you when it, audited for you when we get to the time slot. We cannot look at all the code, it's just too much. So we really focus on the things where the transition from the user to root or similar services, where this actually happens. We also look at technologies and automations to finding and preventing security issues. We also have to look, when we do that, how good are they? What false positive, false negatives they provide? How easy it is to integrate into the build service or into Tumbleweed, and the performance and usability. So security features that cost 10%, 15% performance, the users, we like it, but the users might not like it. So that's always, if we consider including some automatisms or technologies, that's, these criteria are usually considered so that we don't annoy the users too much. So security tries to be not really block everything that's funny or feature-wise, so we have to keep a balance there. So quite old technology, so we'll be talking about some of the technologies. So quite old technology is the built-in buffer overflow checking, largely for stack-based buffer overflows, which fortunately is a very researched problem. So the compiler and glibc provide this, it provides compile time warnings and it provides also runtime aborts and facilitates all the old known functions like strict copy, memcopy, and similar things. So fortunately, it's enableable by just supplying a preprocessor flag. We started using this for slash 10, so really quite a while ago, nearly 10 years ago, and it's working nicely. It's cost no performance, so it's a very good technology. Another Stack Overflow technology is the Stack Protector, which is a heuristic overflow protection. So basically, on top of the stack, there's a canary, a random value, and written on the entry of the function, and if on the exit of the function, it looks if the canary is still there. And if it's not there or different, then it aborts the program. So this is a pure runtime thing. Occasionally it triggers, so we have seen this not very often, but it has triggered occasionally. We also have enabled it for several years, and it's kind of lightweight. So it does cost a very small bit of performance, but it's kind of lightweight. GCC5 brought a new, a bit more improved version of that that facilitates more functions called FStack Protector Strong. And due to all the nice factory magic where we pass in the op flex via a global variable, we switched it on last week, and the current rebuild of factory will be using this flag. A bit more on the background story that I had, of course, to run this through my own staging project because I think 10 packages failed when enabling this option. And the factory integration rules pretty much say that you should not break anything. So I had to fix those 10 packages, which fortunately was not that difficult, before I was allowed, or before the factory maintainers enabled that flag. One other magic thing that is used for exploitation avoidance is address space layout randomization. So if an attacker doesn't know the target addresses of functions or variables, he has a hard time exploiting these pieces. So one method is to randomize these addresses. It's of course not a full solution, but if an attacker is running, you will see segmentation faults. So the attacker might get lucky at some point, but usually not on the first try. And if you know the regular process layout, there's the stack, there are the libraries mapped into the process space, the memory maps, the virtual DSO, and all those four are randomized for quite some time already. That's nice. The problem is that the main binary and also the heap, where all the memory allocations happen, these were not randomized by default. And you actually need to build the binary with a special mode called PI, Position Independent Executable Mode, which is a special compiler and linker flag that needs to be added. And afterwards, also the main binary and heap will be randomized on every start. The last thing, this adding of compile flags, I worked on this a bit and found in a staging project that it really several packages. So it's I tried to enable it for all packages in factory, but I had quite some fallout. So quite a large number of packages failed, or there were some packages like Emacs or others that were hard to fix, that or near impossible to fix. So I currently have postpone this project of building all a factory with Pi at this time, but I will probably pick it up or look at it in the near future again. So that's also not, so performance-wise, that's not also not a big performance impact if we do that. SUSE uses two major security frameworks, AppArmor, you probably have heard about it. We've been using it since LS9. It's kind of well integrated for some services, but we found over the time that it's only useful in some server scenarios where it really is known what will happen. So what files the servers will read and what files the servers will write. It's less useful for things where you don't know what if a user is involved, what the user will do. Like, we try to confine Firefox at some point in time, and the user can save files from Firefox. He can save them everywhere. So what do you allow? So do you just allow the home directory? That would already be very bad. So confining desktop applications where there's a lot of, where there's potential unknown user input was, or is kind of hard to do with AppArmor. It's possible. In the meantime, it uses, for instance, you could allow writing to the whole home directory, but then it kind of defeats the purpose already. Yeah. And the other framework is SE Linux, which is a labeling security framework. It's coming from the labeled security theoretical security world model. SE Linux itself was developed by the NSA and open sourced. We have the tools, but we have no working policies. So policies meaning what is labeled as what, how do labels or how do transitions are made, and even for us it's very complicated to understand. So Red Hat has been integrating SE Linux for some years, but they have a large number of developers working on it that do regular bug fixes that fix like 10 bugs every week. So, and currently we have only Johannes working on it. So that's a kind of limited working power, and we lack a bit the knowledge that Red Hat has gained over the last years. And again, it's still a complex topic, and usable or easy usable tools are not really available or not even possible in a whole model. Yeah, we are also watching other new security models that come in, like the SecComp system call filter, where we really have a small bytecode program that filters the system calls. It's enabled in VSFTP and OpenSSH, for instance, already. We only notice if something breaks, but so far, for those two programs at least, it's working nicely. And then last years, there have also been more of those security frameworks. One tool is the address sanitizer. We actually thought at some point in time that we could build our whole distribution with this. What does it do? Basically, it's a runtime addition for every allocation, for every memory usage, and it provides reliable array overflow checking, even for things that are not on a stack, that are allocated on a heap, and so on. We, however, noticed that it's kind of hard to integrate, that it costs performance, and it has some interesting memory layout constraints that are not always fulfilled. So that one, it's really probably more a developer tool that developers can use to find bugs in their own programs. So it's sadly not something that we can enable for all of the distribution. GCC has also some other sanitizers, so also built into runtime, like bounce checking, integer overflows, object sizes, and so on. It's a big field to explore still, at least for us and I think for Factory. Something that we are more or less indirectly involved with is fuzzing. Fuzzing is, if you don't know it, giving random input to an application and see what happens, see if it crashes or misbehaves in any form, like or hangs or whatever. It's not a new thing. Fuzzing has been done for quite a while, but the technology improved. So, and I think 2 years ago, I'm not sure of the name, Michael Zalewski, I think, published the American Fuzzy Lob fuzzer, which you build your binary with, then it builds an internal call graph, and then starts fuzzing this binary, and it's really optimized to find all the various paths that your program takes. So it doesn't put in not just random stuff, but it sees if it changes a bit or if it changes the value that the call graph or the control flow graph of the program changes, and then it investigates in that direction. So with this kind of heuristic genetic approach, it really gets results very quickly, and almost all image libraries and audio libraries and also TLS, SSL stacks have been meanwhile seen this fuzzer on work, and we as security team then in the end see all the CVEs coming on our table. So like, I think Graphics Magic or Image Magic got like 90 CVEs, but I'm not sure if they came from AFL or from other methods. I think they came mostly from AFL, and it's this year. So people still find things with that, and it's kind of worrisome if we get this amount of security issues, not just for us, but also for you packagers. And I think we have not seen the end of it, because there are still a lot of tools and a lot of libraries that might not have been fuzzed. And while this is probably one of the most advanced fuzzers today, is of course the possibility that new technologies come up, that new technologies of finding bugs are invented that will also find more bugs, and that will in turn come to us on our table, and that we will also need to fix. Yeah, so that caused us more work than probably every other security tool. So how can you help? As users, please install our online updates that makes you more secure. If you see something security related that we might not have seen, like, oh, there's a buffer overflow fixed in the tool, I just submitted a changelog, or I saw in a changelog that there's a buffer overflow fixed, and then we appreciate getting told about it. If it has the CVE ID already, then we probably know about it already, but if you are unsure and have not seen it, then please feel free to tell us. Programming securely, that's easier said than done, but check the warnings, use some of the tools that I mentioned if you're interested. And as I said earlier, also, if you have time, if you want to help out, you can help us fixing some of the abandoned security bugs in the OpenSUSE distribution. So, yeah, that's it from the security point of view. Do you have questions for me? Do we need a microphone or?
Does this work? No? Hello. Okay. So one question. You mentioned that the bugs that you are opening, the CVE bugs, they are public bugs, right?
Yes.
Okay, so how do you coordinate publishing of these bugs with publishing fixes for them?
I don't fully understand.
Okay, so basically if you publish a bug without a fix for it, you are practically publishing a zero-day exploit.
Okay, so basically the bugs that are public in this product are bugs that are publicly known already. So it's basically, Bugzilla is used there for tracking those that are known. So if you get some bugs that are not yet public, then they are marked private, so that only the security team or only the SUSE employees can see it. And if there's no patch, I mean, if the bug is known and publicly posted, then we can also open the bug because the information is available. And hopefully at the same time, people will be working on a patch or having a patch already somewhere.
Yeah. So that's the other thing. The CVEs, for a very specific reason, they don't provide reproduction paths. Basically, trying to kind of stay away from that zero-day scenario. So maybe you need to apply some judgment there. I don't know. I mean.
Yeah. So CVE itself, it's just a dictionary,
right?
So it's not really an authority that coordinates or publishes things. It just coordinates the references to it.
Yeah, but your bugs are contain all that, you know.
Yeah. So we evaluate, of course, the bugs that get reported to us. So in severity, so internally we use the so-called CVSS, Common Vulnerability Scoring System. Mm-hmm. And for our bug fixes, if there are reproducers, we try to attach them to the bug reports. We don't always have the time to create our own reproducers or proof of concepts exploit for those bugs. But mm-hmm. we basically are in a coordinator role. So we collect the information, as much information as possible, and provide them to our packagers or to our QA people. So. But we are not set up in a resource, so we are not as many people that we can rewrite proof of concept exploits for everything, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you communicate with the package authors via the maintainers, right? Like when you have a security bug that you need to communicate to some project, mm-hmm. you would contact the maintainer of that package, and then they would eventually contact the upstream.
Yeah, so one thing is that we internally contact our maintainer, so okay. if we get the knowledge from external, but if we find things in software, then we also contact the upstream developer of the package. Mm-hmm. So, and what I didn't mention is that the distributions have some shared forums, mailing lists, where they coordinate releases or exchange information. There's the OSS security list, which is a public list. And there's also a pre-disclosure list called distros and Linux distros, where we discuss about pre-disclosures. So about like if we found a real bad problem that we don't want to release immediately, but in a week or two, then that is discussed on a closed list. So we are in contact on one side with our developers, but also with the upstream developers, if necessary. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
More questions?
Are there any plan to support the kernel hardened project like the PEX and GR security? Because as I know, Debian and Gentoo have officially have this project to apply it.
Yeah, so I'm personally watching the kernel hardening project. So where people try to get the hardening features into the mainline kernel. We all occasionally get a question about the GR security patches for our kernel. So far, when we discussed this with our kernel development team, they said no, because it's a huge blob of patch and not in separate pieces. So that's something, I mean, where the SUSE kernel team basically has to say of what it wants and what it can include. So, and they at that point in time decided that that one is too intrusive and could not be included at that time. But we very much appreciate that people have externally at least picked up bringing those features into the mainline kernel. And also in the past, some of the features, some smaller parts, have been brought into the mainline kernel already. So we are not. So the security team is not actively supporting it. I'm not sure about our kernel developers. So we have more kernel developers than security guys. So I don't actually know if any one of them is helping there. I don't know.
Thank you.
More questions? Okay, then thank you for listening.